Hello, it's Wednesday, July the 28th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show coming from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, we're going to be talking about the Olympics again, even more medals, and we've now got the most decorated British female Olympian of all time. Why the Prime Minister may now delay a ban on gas boiler installations. The costs will make your eyes water. And why the BBC Countryside presenter Anita Rani thinks possibly she may have got to the final rather than the semi-final of Strictly Come Dancing if she'd been white and not Asian. The lockdown. Why have we added so many pounds to our waistline during the pandemic? The growing revolt on the Tory benches over COVID passports to be compulsory for major events. The Cabinet Office Minister Michael Gove says those who refuse a vaccination are selfish and are putting other people's lives at risk. Gove made the remarks as he revealed plans for use of the vaccine passport could be extended beyond bars and clubs to include some large events such as football matches. Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown is the Conservative MP for the Cotswolds, a leading member of the 1922 Executive Committee of Tory MPs, and he joins me now. Sir Geoffrey, a lot of Tory MPs are just fundamentally opposed to the idea of a vaccine passport to enable you perhaps to get into the theatre, a concert or a football match. What is that opposition based on?
It's based on the fact that we don't want to cause divisions in society. We're not, and I hope we never will get to a position where, for anything, we ever make it compulsory to have a vaccination for any disease. It should be entirely over one's body and entirely a voluntary decision. On that basis, it's quite wrong to make it compulsory to go into certain events. And I think, actually, the current situation where cases have come down for 7 days, it looks as though we're on the right trend on this COVID virus. And I think by September, when it's supposed to come in, it will be quite outdated anyway.
What of the idea, though, that some organisations, perhaps a theatre, may say to potential customers, if that's the right word, theatre goers, you can't come into my production unless you can either show you've had the vaccination or there has to be some form of COVID passport?
Well, I don't object to an individual theatre saying that, because that's an individual theatre can impose its own conditions on its customers. But the customers have a right not to go to that theatre. What I would be opposed to is if the government made it a blanket requirement for all theatres, say, or all football matches or whatever, all concerts, to have a compulsory vaccine passport before they could go in. That would be quite wrong, because people wouldn't have a freedom of choice as to which venue they went to.
If they were to argue that they would perhaps do it for nightclubs, for instance, you and I, Sir Geoffrey, are unlikely to be in the queue for a nightclub at our advanced age. But many people under the age of 30 will want to go to nightclubs, and they're the group which are either resisting the vaccination or the government just hasn't got round to them yet.
Well, I think the government has got round to them, because of any under 30-year-old that wants the jab, and I've got people in my office who have had them, they can get them if they go to
right.
They might have to travel a bit, but they can get them. And I would say, I think it's really important to say that as at the moment, the advantage of having the jab is so much greater than not having the jab, that we should encourage everybody over 18 to have the jab. I think that's got to be said. But for those that don't, for whatever reason, wish to have the jab, it's quite wrong to make them have to produce a compulsory piece of paper or something on their phone in order to get into a venue. That is completely alien to the British way of life.
What of Michael Gove's suggestion? He chose his words carefully. He's a very articulate cabinet minister. He says those who refuse a vaccination are selfish. Is he right?
No, I don't think he is. I think, again, that's alien to the whole British way of life. We are a free society. It's up to every single one of us. I've decided to have a vaccine. No doubt you have.
I have.
Good. And that's our decision. But anybody, whether they be young or old, who decides for whatever reason they don't want to have the vaccine, that's their decision. And that's the way this country works. And so I think to criticise those who voluntarily decide not to have the vaccine is wrong. Encourage them, yes, but criticise them, no.
If I could ask you just finally, the government, as you know, was given extraordinary powers by Parliament during the course of this pandemic. In your view, if they were to try to make this a compulsory issue, perhaps for football matches or mass events, should that be something that has to be voted on by MPs in the House of Commons?
Well, I voted against extending the compulsory powers from June to September, and I will vote against if they try and extend the compulsory powers beyond September. I think it would be quite wrong to use the compulsory powers in this way, and at the very least, which is what I've been arguing for many issues throughout this COVID pandemic, some yes, some no, Parliament should be given a vote on this matter. And I believe the belief amongst Conservative members of Parliament is growing that we shouldn't have these compulsory COVID vaccine passports, and I think that they would have some difficulty getting it through Parliament.
Very interesting. That's Sir Geoffrey Clifton-Brown, who is the Conservative MP for the Cotswolds. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with all our other podcasts and video series. And, of course, don't forget to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So it's no secret, actually, that quite a few of us have added a few pounds in weight over the course of the pandemic. Public Health England have surveyed 5,000 adults and found that, on average, we've put on half a stone, with one in five of us adding more than a stone over the 16 months of lockdown. Aisling Piggott is a registered dietitian and spokeswoman for the British Dietetics Association, and she joins me now. Over a stone is not good, is it, Aisling? That is bad news.
I think it's sometimes really hard to use that very strong language about kind of good and bad when it comes to weight. What we know is that as a society, if our weight is constantly increasing, then it's not ideal. But we need to stop demonising it with these really strong words like it's not good or it's bad.
But it isn't good though, is it?
From a population perspective, absolutely not. We don't want to see obesity rates continuing to rise. For an individual, without knowing their individual circumstances, it's really difficult to comment. But we know that it's best looking after weight, and that weight gain during the pandemic has been an issue, and it's something that needs to be addressed, but not in a blame kind of way, but from a societal level.
Right. Is the problem, in your view, Aisling, the fact that if we were working from home, the temptation, the lure of the fridge or the pantry was just proving too much, and we were perhaps snacking, whereas if we were in an office or factory or our normal work environment, that temptation isn't there?
I think definitely when we look at obesity or weight gain in general, it's generally quite complex and multifactorial. We know that that is definitely a part of it, where actually we've been less active and out and about more and have had more, or out and about less and have had more exposure to food and choices to eat. But that's only one small part of the picture. What we've seen is actually people who are already living with obesity and maybe more prone to gaining weight have been disproportionately affected by lockdown measures, because they may be more likely to have been shielding or not been able to access their usual health services. So those people may have gained more weight than perhaps they would have in the usual space of time, as well as all those other factors that we've all experienced, kind of being surrounded by food being an option, not having as much access to physical activity, not having as much motivation to get on and to choose the healthy foods, or to choose the right foods for our body.
I guess also, if you're working from home, you're not walking to a bus stop or to a train station. You're probably doing less exercise as well. And exercise, of course, is an important part of keeping us fit.
Absolutely. And we've definitely seen, whilst we don't have lots of long-term data on this yet, we've definitely seen lots of data coming through, particularly around childhood obesity, where children have been spending much more time indoors, not commuting to school, and then we're likely to see the same data coming through from adults. We're seeing it about weight gain. But yeah, we're much less active. And time disappears. That time we're saving on a commute, we think, oh, great, we can do a workout with that. We can do something with that. But it's not that easy when we're in the moment to try and fill it and to keep going. And often our jobs have gotten busier for many people. They've got more pressure to perform. So many people that I speak to or work with are actually working longer hours, having less lunch breaks, and giving themselves less self-care time than ever before.
Yeah, and I know the government have relaunched the Better Health campaign, which has got a website which gives all sorts of ideas. What's your advice to people listening to this, Aisling, who know they've put on maybe half a stone, maybe a stone? What's the most important thing to do to try and get rid of that weight?
I think the very most important thing to do is to stop sitting there beating yourself up or surrounded by negative messages, and making yourself feel bad about gaining weight is often a big driver for future weight gain. So actually starting to think, right, we're here now, let's not sit here and poke at our stomach or look at our unhappy bits, but try and think about focusing on the health choices that we can make to look after our body and our shape and our size, not just our weight. And then my next bit of advice would be try and start to look after yourself. Incorporate some self-care into your day, into your routine, as opposed to trying to punish yourself with exercise, which is often the message we get when we listen to health experts, when we listen to advice about looking after our body. And the final thing is just view food as fuel, something that's nourishing, not something that needs to be divided into demonized foods and very healthy foods. It's all nourishing, just making sure that we're feeding ourselves the right type regularly, as opposed to cutting out and going on extremely restrictive fatty diet.
Very interesting advice. That's Aisling Piggott, who is spokeswoman for the British Dietetics Association, and she's also a registered dietitian. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, videos, opinion pieces, and much, much more. If you want to get in touch, you can tweet us at mailplus or me at ToryBoyPierce. Boris Johnson is reportedly considering delaying a ban on gas boiler installations by 5 years because the cost of the eco-friendly alternatives are thought to be, frankly, too high. It's not just boilers. Some measures to make your home more energy efficient could take up to 70 years to recoup the initial cost. Harry Wallop, the consumer journalist, has been looking at the economics of going green and joins me now. Harry, some of those figures in your piece today, eye-watering.
Yeah, because they're promoted to us, or a lot of these measures are promoted to us as essentially ways to save money. You know, swap your boiler, lag your house, and you will save a shed load of money off your energy bills. And that's sort of how it's presented to us. But if you actually look into, in fact, the government's own figures, their own estimates, it's just not quite true. They may be doing an awful lot to save the planet, but they're not helping your bills in most cases.
The gas boilers were due to be, we all had to get rid of them, I think, was it by 2035, Harry?
Well, that was, yeah, there's two dates. There's one right. Getting rid of gas boilers in new builds, and I think that was by 2030. And then for all gas boilers, I think it was 2035, though the goalposts do keep shifting. But the problem is that the alternative to a gas boiler is two things, and they're both hideously expensive. One is a heat pump.
Yeah.
Clever idea, but just very expensive, and it runs on electricity. And the other one is a hydrogen boiler, which frankly doesn't even exist yet.
Yeah.
So that's sort of pie in the sky, let alone it being affordable to most people.
And when you say expensive, Harry, it could a heat pump could cost up to £20,000.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it's not just the initial outlay of the heat pump. It's not going to save you anything on your bills on a ongoing basis. So it's terrible value for money. I mean, they are better. They are definitely better for the environment than a gas boiler. But you've got to be incredibly, you've got to love the planet. You've got to be a real tree hugger to decide to get rid of your cheap, perfectly efficient gas boiler to put in one of these heat pumps.
Yeah, and energy performance certificates, all home sellers and landlords have got to provide these to buyers and tenants since 2007. One recommendation solid floors, which cut down on carbon emissions, would save you £84 a year, according to your piece, and reduce heating bills. The cost to install it, up to £6,000. It's for the birds, isn't it, all of this?
Yeah. So these EPCs are really interesting. They're one of those sort of, like a traffic light system. You get it with your house and everything is ranked, your house is ranked green to red, green, grey, red, ooh, alarming. And the government wants everything to get a bit better. And they come with suggestions, which are quite helpful, actually, of what you might want to do. The problem is that most of the suggestions are really expensive like this. So double glazing, we all know that double glazing, that's a good idea. Yeah, that would stop heat escaping from the house. But the average cost of double glazing And this is only for a three-bed semi. It's £4,900. How much are you going to save off your energy bill? £75. It just, you know, it just doesn't make any economic sense. I mean, you may want to do it because you prefer to have a slightly warmer house. It's a bit cozier. It might help with noise pollution. But forget the idea that you're doing it to save any money.
And I love this too. Solar panels, they'll save you the great sum of £120 a year, as long as you don't mind paying £6,200 to install them.
Yeah, I mean, solar panels,
so ugly
really,
as well.
Really?
They're horrible.
The thing is, though, they used to make sense because there was a nice big
government grant, I remember,
to install them, but that's gone because it made no sense for the taxpayer to be funding these. So this is the problem. We need to, you know, there needs to be a radical new way of looking about how to make our homes greener, because a lot of our energy that we use does come from our homes, so we do need to make our homes greener. But at the moment, trying to persuade us to upgrade stuff to greener versions and then claim it's going to help us save on our energy bills isn't the right way to do it.
It seems the penny's dropped in Downing Street, so it's going cold on these proposals, which I'm utterly convinced the Prime Minister was signed up to in the first place by his very eco-friendly wife, Carrie.
I couldn't possibly comment. I don't know what goes on inside the Prime Minister's brain. But yeah, this is the problem. There is a breed of eco-campaigners who don't seem to appreciate that, in fact, you know what? Most people do want it. They do want to help the planet. They do want to do their bit. But they don't want to do their bit if at the end of the month they look at their bills and think, hang on a sec, it's costing me more than it was before.
Absolutely. Harry, you've done a great service to all of us. I hope the Prime Minister's read every word of it. I'm sure somebody will have referred it to him, and I think that's going to make him even more determined to slow it all down. That's Harry Wallop, consumer journalist. Read him in the Mail today. So, another big day in the Olympic Stadium and in the Olympic pool in particular. Matt Gatwood, Deputy Sports Editor of Mail, is here to tell all. We won't go straight into dressage, Matt, because we know that's your favourite subject. But another great day in the pool for Team GB.
Yes, but it's amazing turnaround from they're now ruling the pool, Team GB are. If you think back to London 2012, the hosts didn't win a race at the London Olympics. And now we can't stop winning medals. So the funding was slashed, but 9 years on, they've now turned it around and are being incredibly successful. So the latest gold today was the men's 4x200 meter relay, which used to be dominated by the Americans. Obviously, they had people like Michael Phelps,
who won so many medals.
Yeah. And now he's out the way. It's opened the door for the Brits, but the Brits have stormed through it. The 4x2 with Tom Dean and Duncan Scott, of course, who won gold and silver yesterday. They were part of this four with a teenager, a guy called Matt Richards and James Guy. And I don't know whether you saw the footage, but it was brilliant. James Guy was in floods of tears even before they've completed it. And Matt Richards, this 18-year-old who did the third leg.
Which transformed the race, because he put them firmly in the lead, and the anchor was apparently always going to win because he's the fastest anchor in relay.
Indeed, and they were, you know, it was pretty neck and neck when Matt Richards dived in. So the fact that he developed such a lead was sensational. So,
and there's a great human interest story there, Matt, because his mum, who's a teacher, used to get up at 3 a.m, drive him to Wolverhampton so he could train. She'd sleep in the car. Brilliant. Drive him back, and then she'd go to work as a teacher in a classroom. These parents are extraordinary, the unsung heroes.
Well, the sacrifices they make and have to make in order for their kids to be successful. It's quite something. So it's lovely to see. It's lovely to see we're being successful in the pool, and long may it last. So it's good.
Yeah. And now rowing, we normally do very well at the rowing.
Yeah, now on the flip side, so the rowing, which is obviously the one that we've dominated in, GB have been dominant in the rowing for years. In fact, the men's four has been the one that we've won gold in the last five Olympics. So, you know, we've absolutely bossed that event. Now, that all came unstuck today. They didn't win, and not only did they not win, rowing sort of turned on itself with a sort of internal row. So they came fourth in the end, but they had steering problems, nearly veered into the Italians, who were going for silver.
Well, that's revenge for the football.
Bit of revenge for the Euro final, exactly.
Yeah, I'm up for that.
Bumped the Italians from silver down into bronze.
Shame.
But finished fourth themselves. And then some of the guys in the boat, Matt Rossiter, who was one of the four, sort of said how he thought that the Cracknell and Pinsent Brigade would be pleased that they hadn't won gold, so that all the gold was for them.
Oh, they were the veterans who were winning gold.
They were the ones who winning gold, you know, they sort of in the Redgrave era.
Yeah.
And so they've sort of had a go at them.
Isn't isn't it?
Yeah, and now Cracknell's obviously come back and said, well, I don't know where that's come from. That's all rubbish. You know, yeah. As he rightly points out, 17 years since he last rode. Why would he not want the British team to win a medal? So
quite.
I don't know whether these boys, you know, A, they've not done very well in the boat and then had some steering issues. Then B, it looks like they've sort of compounded the error by them going on the attack when really they should have just lost graciously.
Yeah, so, just be a good loser.
Yeah, just be a good loser. So rowing, a bit of a problem, sort of eating itself. So, yeah, there we go.
And Andy Murray's out the tennis.
Andy Murray's gone out the tennis. Obviously, you know, he's now suggesting that will be his last Olympics, which you can obviously understand. Yeah. You know, be almost surprised if he plays at Wimbledon next year, let alone the next Olympics. So end of an era for him, having obviously won the last two golds in the singles event. So, but he lost in the doubles, so he's gone. And Charlotte Dujardin, I know you wanted to talk about her. I know you were desperate
Your favourite
to talk
sport.
About her.
Yeah.
So she won bronze, which, because it's a new horse, as we know, who we all know the new horse is called Gio. Yeah. But on Gio, she got a bronze medal. So that takes her to 6 Olympic medals, which makes her the most medalled British Olympian female. So
good for her.
Very good for her.
Because she got bronze in the team as well, didn't she? Yeah. So who's she overtaken?
Kathy Granger.
Oh, I met her once. She's a terrific woman.
Terrific woman.
She was a rower.
She was a rower and she got 5 medals, as did Kitty McCain.
Right.
Back
who's
in the
she?
20s.
Oh, okay.
Tennis player.
I introduced Kathy Granger to Tony Blair.
Really?
Yeah, he was thrilled to meet an Olympian, such a successful Olympian.
I hope so too. Was she thrilled to meet Tony Blair?
Not sure she was. Would you be?
I'm not sure. I'll pass on that one.
Any other Olympic information?
We also won a silver in the rowing sculls. So it wasn't all doom and gloom for the rowers, because the sculls, who we weren't expected to do well in, they picked up a silver. So
is that male or female?
Male.
Great.
So it wasn't all doom
so
and gloom.
So we're still in the top 6 in the medal table?
We're still in the top 6. We're doing, you know, we're sort of on target. So it was, another decent day, but with lots of intrigue and good stories everywhere.
And what's coming up tomorrow? Anything good? Anything to look forward to?
So we've got the athletics starts on Friday.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what's tomorrow. It's just come so thick and fast.
Yeah, I know.
To keep
every
up
morning
with.
You turn the radio on.
I know.
We won another
here
gold.
Here we go again. So yeah, there'll be plenty more. There'll be plenty more action, but I just can't quite remember where.
All right, that's Matt Gatwood as ever, on top of his brief, deputy sports editor of the Daily Mail. So the BBC presenter Anita Rani has questioned whether she might actually have reached the final of Strictly Come Dancing. She was knocked out in the semis if she didn't have a brown face. In her recently published memoir, The Right Sort of Girl, the Woman's Hour and Country of Our presenter speaks candidly about her career and the impact of her race on her success. Eleanor Sharples is the Daily Mail's TV and radio critic and joins me now. Eleanor, look, I'm a huge fan of Strictly. I don't even remember being in it, to be honest. But I don't remember there people particularly saying it was a swizz because she didn't get through to the final. It is a public vote, of course.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, she did unbelievably well. I mean, I'm sure a lot of celebrities would have liked to be in the semi-finals. But yeah, I mean, it was a great year that year with Jane McGuinness winning. So yeah, there didn't seem to be any uproar or outrage about it at the time. And I know she was really grateful and was delighted with how far she'd got in some quotes I read following her exit. So yeah, it's something that she discussed in her new memoir, The Right Sort of Girl. And questioning whether actually, you know, would she have got to that final if she didn't have a brown face?
Yeah, she said, I find some of this a bit odd. She said, I still rush excitedly over to the telly if there's someone Asian on it. And that's why seeing a brown lass doing all right and Strictly meant such a lot to Asian people. It's a national institution. You don't see many brown faces on it. Well, we've done the homework here. 4 non-white celebrities have won Strictly over 17 years. And my great friend from Good Morning Britain, Ranveer Singh, did really well in the very last competition.
Yes, she did brilliantly. And we've had... even Oria Duba, he won, I think in 2016. Alicia Dixon was one of the first in 2007.
And she was a judge.
And yes, she was a judge straight. Yeah, not long after, actually, following her victory. So yeah, it's been, you know, it's been brilliant. You know, Mark Ramprakash was quite early as well, and he's got some Guyanese in him. So it's an interesting one why she's brought it up and kind of felt like she wanted to bring it up now, particularly and in her memoir.
Because I'm just looking, she was born to Indian parents in Yorkshire. She's had a pretty good career as a broadcaster. She was privately educated. She's presented Watchdog and other top shows. And whenever I've looked at her, I always get into trouble when I say these sort of things. I don't think, oh, there's an Asian girl doing well. I just think, oh, there's Anita Rani, who's a very good broadcaster.
Absolutely, totally agree. And she also hosts Radio 4's Women's Hour. So she's done so much in her time. And, you know, with things like Country File as well.
Yeah.
There's not one bit of me that would ever look at her and think, gosh, she hasn't, you know, why is she there? I mean, she's clearly just a fantastic broadcaster who's done so much in her career now that actually, you know, she's one of the biggest faces on the BBC in particular.
Yeah, and I think there was some talk when she got the presenter's role on Country File that she broke the mould, because Country File, if you think about the British countryside, rural matters, yes, it is not particularly multiracial. It's pretty white. And there she is, yes, a proud Asian girl, as one of the presenters.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. No, you're right, Andrea. It's she's just done fantastically for herself. I do find it quite strange. I mean, maybe if she'd have got knocked out earlier in the competition, I don't know whether that would have been a bit more of a big deal. But she still got to the semi-final, and at that point in the competition, it's just, you know, it's hard to, you know, decide between like the top five best
artists.
They usually do stand out. So
I know, and people sometimes vote for their favourites, even if they're not very good dancers, because they just like them. She told Radio Times just finally, didn't she, Eleanor, that she decided to address the question of Strictly. I put that Strictly question into my book, which is called The Right Sort of Girl, to leave people pondering, because I'm just not sure. I wonder if she's saying it because it helps sell a book.
Yeah, I mean, maybe. Definitely. And, you know, a lot of Strictly fans probably will quite enjoy reading that chapter maybe as well. So, yeah, quite possibly. And, she clearly isn't sure as well within herself with those quotes, but she's kind of putting it out there for other people to kind of make what they think of it.
Yeah, exactly. Well. And when is Strictly next on the screens? Am I missing something?
Oh, well, hopefully, if we are going, obviously last year it was affected because of COVID, it started later, but hopefully it usually takes place around the third week of September, usually gets going then, with also a big like red carpet glitzy type of thing on August bank holiday. So hopefully it's going to run as normal, you know, same number of celebrities as usual, but I'm actually meeting some people next week to kind of get a bit more of a firmer idea on the structure and how it's going to go this year.
And you're to come straight into this studio and tell us all about it, Eleanor.
Absolutely. I'm on countdown for it.
The podcast loves Strictly, and we love it when you talk to us all about it. That's Eleanor Sharples, the Daily Mail's very fine TV and radio critic. Thanks for joining us. That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again, if you can bear to. I am Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back tomorrow. Have yourselves a great evening and good night.